I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. Pierce Secunda is both an artist and a documentarian. He was born in London and studied painting at the Chelsea College of Art. But he doesn't paint on canvas. Instead, he layers the product to create assemblage art that looks like sculpture. While on residency in China, he watched members of the Chinese army practice their shooting skills by firing into sheets of cured paint. The resulting bullet holes looked more like flowers, and that inspired Secunda to create a new practice, one that brings together his craft and his personal belief that an artist should record the world around him. Secunda traveled to Iraq in 2015, where he created works of art using casts of ISIS bullet holes taken from the cultural sites destroyed by the group. I spent an afternoon with him at the Long Sharp Gallery in downtown Indianapolis, experiencing his exhibit.
My name is Pierce Secunda, and I'm an artist. The only other recollection that I have of wanting to do anything else was when I was very, very small, I wanted to fly. And so I jumped from one bed to another in my bedroom, and I went off sideways, and I hit my head on the corner of a cabinet, and there was sort of arterial spray coming out of my head. And so flying was out, and then next thing was art, and, you know, I'm still holding on to it. And so I developed a way of making sculptures, effectively, out of paint. I call them sculptures because they're three-dimensional. ISIS have carried out the biggest swathe of cultural destruction that the Middle East has ever seen. The extent of the looting and the desecration of these sites is greater than anyone could really have ever imagined. At the same time, there are some sites which they damaged incredibly badly, like Palmyra in Syria, where a lot of it still remains, but some of the most important iconic structures are obliterated. It's a way of erasing the past, and it's extremely important to understand the erasure of the past in the context of these damaged artifacts, because that breaking of the link between who we are and what we do and the ancient world and what it did and how it functioned and what it means historically to us in the present day is very much alive. And if you break that link, you disconnect yourself from the past. It's literally it's like taking an eraser and rubbing out history. If you do that, you stop people understanding who they are, what their humanity is, where their history came from, and what it means. And I felt that was just simply way too big, given the scale of what they're doing, to ignore. So I started trying to document it. And I make a factually accurate document by using a molding material called alginate, which is used to cast your teeth in a dentist's chair. And alginate produces a forensic quality reproduction of a texture, of a surface. And so I use that material, I take it with me, and I make molds of damage. In this instance, in this exhibition, damage carried out by ISIS to ancient artifacts. I've gone to these places and I've made molds of the bullet holes. I haven't molded the actual relief sculptures or whichever sculptures I'm making the work out of. I've acquired those commercially, and there are a variety of different places that you can buy those. And they're usually Victorian casts or early 20th century casts. I buy those because they're very affordable and they're very, very good quality reproductions. And then I superimpose effectively the bullet damage or the power tool damage on those reproductions. And through molding, I'm able to impose the bullet holes and the bullet damage on the surfaces of those works. These works serve as a metaphor for the destruction of culture, which happens, you know, in this instance, under ISIS. With the exception occasionally of the eyes in the relief sculptures, I don't compose I don't organize the composition of where the bullet holes go. It's random. I put them in a box, and they're rubber, and I drop them into the form, the mold of this sculpture, and where they land, I turn them the right way up, and then I pour the paint, and I make my work of art.
What do you want people to take away from your work?
If people come and look at it and they feel slightly emotionally charged as a result, for me that's a good thing, because awareness is, I think, a key to understanding, and then they can go away and look it up and learn about it, talk about it.
Sukunda continues to create his art and share his mission at galleries, public spaces, and private collections around the world. Each week we bring you Making It, the story of a local DIY or do-it-yourself artist. Today, WFYI's Melissa Davis takes us into the studio of an artist who plays in two bands, White Moms and Service.
Hey,
hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Good. This is our place.
But yeah, we've been here for like a year. And then we keep all the equipment in here, in the cool part where I hang out, the control room.
I'm Charlene Birdsong, and I am a musician and audio engineer. I think I'm passionate about recording and music because it's a way to relieve stress, express myself, and have time to myself and sort of organize the feelings I have inside of me in music.
How does place factor into your art?
When you say that, I imagine like being in my basement and feeling comfortable and making a lot of noise, being loud. And I write most of my stuff when I'm testing my equipment and with just checking my levels.
I like to mess with the tones.
I come up with melodies and things like that. So place can make me feel more creative, but I do notice that after certain experiences like touring or just traveling or something like that, I feel more creative, and that creative freedom that happens in my basement sort of moves with me. So after a tour, I can come home and I'm more likely to write a song when I'm out and about walking or something like that. So place is a big part of it for me when I'm writing. I think performing, it doesn't really matter, but I think writing, it's important where you are. The one I've been working on most recently that I made a video for.
We're using this in a service song, just as like a sample to go under vocals or like to build up a part of a song. Sort of just like adding an environment to the song that's already just a straightforward rock and roll song.
How does Indianapolis factor into your art?
The people here definitely have found some musical soulmates here. So it helps and it hurts, I think. When it hurts, it also helps the music. So it feels like I have some musical peers, some equals, some people that feel it like I do. So who knows if those people would be other places than Indianapolis, but I'm very grateful for the people that I have here, and they've definitely inspired me creatively, and especially the local hip-hop scene right now has really sort of like ignited an inspiration in me, seeing the performers and just like Leaving Trees recently. That excites me and gets the creative juices flowing to see someone on stage pour their heart out like that over and over and over again all day. And I've been making music for podcasts. Yeah. So she's doing something for, it's like ghost stories, like Indiana ghost stories. So she wanted like a creepy intro, and I had written this and showed it to her, so she had some vocals over it. It sounds really scary now.
What sparked your interest in this career in being a sound designer, recording engineer?
Making my own music, sort of, and making my own music alone. I think the first recording device I got was a little cassette recorder, so I would try to just write songs and get them down, and then I got my 4-track cassette recorder, and I was able to layer those. Also, I think that I'm a forever student, so I always want to learn something. So when the opportunity came for me to learn something new in audio engineering and learning how to use a reel-to-reel and learning how to handle equipment and tape and all the rules of sound design, things that are intuitive but require experience and knowledge, sort of like hooked me in. Audio engineering is a never-ending learning experience, so it's a way for me that I found to continuously be a student and just, you know, keep getting more and more information. That's my favorite part of it, honestly, is just being able to learn, you know, and getting those certificates. It feels so good to get a certificate. I don't know, I like that.
How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
We're cat people at our house, my wife and I, and we've had this one cat for about 19 years, and we're kind of waiting for it to kick the bucket. We love him, but we spend a lot of time cleaning up after him nowadays. So cats have been on my mind especially, so I was looking for cat poems the other day, and I found this great cat poem. It's kind of a half cat, half monster poem. It feels like kind of a 1960s monster movie to me. It's by Edward Field from his book After the Fall, and it's called Curse of the Catwoman. It sometimes happens that the woman you meet and fall in love with is of that strange Transylvanian people with an affinity for cats. You take her to a restaurant, say, or a show, on an ordinary date, being attracted by the glitter in her slitty eyes and her cat-like walk, and afterward, of course, you take her in your arms, and she turns into a black panther and bites you to death. Or perhaps you are saved in the nick of time, and she is tormented by the knowledge of her tendency, that she daren't hug a man unless she wants to risk clawing him up. This puts you both in a difficult position. Panting lovers who are prevented from touching, not by bars, but by circumstance. You have terrible fights and say cruel things, for having the hots does not give you a sweet temper. One night you are walking down a dark street and hear the pad-pad of a panther following you. But when you turn around, there are only shadows, or perhaps one shadow too many. You approach, calling, "Who's there?" And it leaps on you. Luckily, you have brought along your sword, and you stab it to death. And before your eyes, it turns into the woman you love, her breast impaled on your sword, her mouth dribbling blood saying she loved you, but couldn't help her tendency. So death released her from the curse at last, and you knew from the angelic smile on her dead face that in spite of a life the devil owned, love had won, and heaven pardoned her.
I almost think the writer might be a dog person.
Oh, yeah, that could be. I can see that, where maybe he's not a cat lover.
Or a cat lover and wishing for that 10th life for the cat.
Yes, that could be. Or a cat lover like me waiting for his cat to go gently into that good night.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, tearing it down.
And they took a big wrecking ball and kind of went through the whole avenue and kind of destroyed a lot of the establishments.
And building it up.
You'd better stop now, or Mama's gonna get your butt.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. The Harrison Brooks Center at 40th and Cornelius is a safe place for the mentally and emotionally challenged, using jazz music as a calming and bonding agent. It's also a gathering place for seniors, musicians, poets, and performers. And it all started with one mother's quest to find a space for her autistic and nonverbal son. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams takes us there.
My name is Edith Glover, and you are at the Harrison Brooks Center. The Harrison Brooks Center is a place that I purchased and remodeled and so on and so forth so that I could have somewhere for my son and myself to go to enjoy live music. My son is autistic, and a lot of the other environments are just not that friendly with cigarette smoke and all of the din of people moving about and so on and so forth. So I had to sort of create a place that would work for me, him, and anybody else that needed a place like that.
And who else comes here since you've opened your doors?
Oh, I've had various people from the community, from the neighborhood, friends, family, individuals with special needs. That's what I do. Full-time, I have a business for people with special needs to help them stay in the community. So that's been sort of how I evolved from seeing that there were things available for them and then just widening it to offer it to seniors, which is the most recent thing that I'm doing now.
Why this particular neighborhood? I know there's some history behind it, but why here on Cornelius?
Mainly because the neighborhood is where I associate the music coming from. And I just feel that it should stay there and should be available to the people that are still there in the neighborhood. We don't do things that frequently just because we're starting to get it going up again. But every Thursday I have it open for the poets, Midtown Poets. They have poetry night here. And they average anywhere from 20 to 25 people. When I do give music events here with the jazz or the blues and whatnot, we usually average 30 to 40 people at a time. And we may do that once a month or every other month or something like that.
And you have some other cohorts here who are...
I do.
My name is Camille Thomas, and I work with Miss Glover, and I also work with her company, LEL Home Services, that she was referring to. I open and close the building. I basically try to take care of the building along with a guy named Chris Matthews. And we also, Ms. Glover didn't mention, but on every second Monday of the month, we have
jazz and mocktails.
And that focuses on having a lot of individuals from the LEL Home Services come in. We have music and food, and we have a set event. Probably when you are walking around, you notice the drums, so they made drums. We have all kind of things.
And sitting next to you, somebody else who is involved.
My name is Cassandra Thomas, and my involvement has been pretty recent with Ms. Glover in that we have kicked off our first senior program called Ages and Stages. And so we host an event here for seniors ages 60 and above, and they can come in and enjoy an evening of live jazz music. And so we're just getting that kicked off. We've established an advisory committee, and so we're looking forward to our next event.
Ms. Glover, this is more than just a place for people with autism or other challenges. This has become a community center.
It certainly has. Just because music is community, you know, it goes beyond having autism or having any kind of disability. The music is community. So I've opened it up to have more people come in and to enjoy it.
And music means something special to the communication between you and your son.
It does. It wasn't until I began to sing things to my son that he began to respond to me, versus me just giving a motherly command like, you better stop, you better not, you know? If I sang that to him, he was more responsive.
How would you sing that to him?
You'd better stop now, or mama's gonna get your butt.
And the response?
I stopped.
So the seniors that come in, and the music that's focused on here, which is jazz, tell me about the relationship between elderly in the inner city community and the touchstone of jazz.
Well, I actually started working with seniors when I used to work for a company called Arts for Learning, and we had a senior program there, and we were able to go around and bring in artists to work with some of the seniors. And we found one of the most positive art forms was music. And we found that they, when exposed to that type of music, it brought them calm. It brought them a place to escape to. And they found listening to music that they can't really turn on the radio and hear a lot these days.
Tell me about open mic night.
We're going to begin in a few. We got Sister Tamara Elon G going around, making sure people are getting on the mic. And it's special. We're so glad you are here.
All right, I got a few different names. My name is Sir Noble Jabu, Uniqua Ganadu, and Al Peel of the Field, and also Synergy, and also Albert Paul Spalding Jr. is the name my parents gave me. And I'm glad to be host of Cafe Kumba on a regular basis over here at the Harrison Brook Center.
So how did you get this gig?
Oh man, I tell you what, it's quite interesting. I was starting my life all over. I was out of town, and after coming back home and got reconnected with Cafe Kumba, and they said, hey, we need some youth over here, you know, some strong youth. And I was like, hey, you know, I'm all about Cafe Kumba. This is a place that really allowed me to get on the mic and express myself.
With respect, honor, class. Beautiful. It's so beautiful. It's so beautiful. So beautiful.
Oh, open mic night. That's with Cafe Kumba. And they come in and they have open night with open night poetry. But a lot of times, you know, people come in that do things other than poetry. It is open night.
I'm going to tell the story how I got the name, the professor. Okay. I do a lot of reading. I read everything. I read Martin Luther. I read Malcolm X. I read Malcolm Speak. I read Andrew Davis. I read Huey Newton. I read Malthy Tongue. I read Rollo May. I read.
You're so late getting home from the office.
Do you have jazz groups coming in here and also playing and or rehearsing or performing? Or
I do.
The perspective of jazz, why jazz?
Because that's the music that I know, that's the music that was in my house, that was the music that kept me bonded to my mom, my family, my life, my roots. So why not jazz?
And now your son?
and my son. Now, actually, he likes blues. And he likes the more they moan and groan, the better he likes it. So I do bring in blues from time to time just to let him get his blues groove on, you know. So,
So where do you see this place in as a community center in 10 years?
In 10 years, I would like to see it as a more of a conservatory of jazz and blues, maybe being a school, a place where younger musicians can come in and be mentored, you know, without it necessarily having to be an academic thing, but back to the way that it used to be. You could come in and you could learn from those that knew the music rather than those that just taught the music, you know.
So that would be in addition to continuing to take care of and mentor to challenged individuals in the community?
Oh, that will always be. That will always be. So that's something that is just ongoing, you know, it's ongoing.
For Curious Mix, this is Bob Williams.
Sound Expeditions is an audio soundtrack of Indianapolis, curated by local arts enthusiast Michael Kaufman, one of the musicians who used both original music and natural sound to create a song on the soundtrack is Carrington Clinton. Curious Mix contributor Kyle Long shares his song and story.
Where do we start? I'll tell you what, let's start at the beginning, Indianapolis.
My name is Carrington Clinton, and my piece is Through These Portals. I chose Georgia because it was heavy traffic, like kind of like the Chatterbox, where a lot of musicians played there on a nightly basis. And they had this really interesting sign right above the exit door that said, Through These Portals. What it meant was, through these portals, you would find all these, like, interesting musicians and these people that were telling interesting stories with their instruments. Georgia's is on Indiana Avenue, and Indiana Avenue is this very historic street that has a lot of cool bars where a lot of jazz musicians and very talented musicians and singers play on a nightly basis. So Indiana Avenue is not here anymore, pretty much due to city expansion and gentrification. And so the city decided one morning to demolish it. And they took a big wrecking ball and kind of went through the whole avenue and kind of destroyed a lot of the establishments. And now we don't have really that same historic street. When I produce, I primarily make sort of hip-hop influence music, but also draw from a lot of jazz influences because I'm also a jazz musician. And with hip-hop, traditionally there's a lot of sampling involved in producing. So I sampled the chord progressions of Freddie Hubbard's Red Clay during the bridge. So I found those chord progressions, and then I mimic those on a synthesizer, and then I put sort of like a backbeat to it. So you can catch up with me on all socials, on Instagram, Clint Breeze in the Groove, and Clint Breeze for Prez is my personal page. So yeah, that's just a little bit about me, and yeah, you can catch me on all stuff.
On the first Friday of every month, the congregation of Temple Adith B'nai Israel in Evansville marks the start of Shabbat in a way few other synagogues do. Curious Mix contributor Isaiah Seibert introduces us to its folk rock house band, Kippa Groovin.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom and good evening and welcome. We are
Rabbi Gary Mazo tells his congregation this won't be their usual Shabbat service. Tonight, a handful of the band's founding members, who now live across the country, are back.
This is always where we turn things over to the band.
Most synagogues don't have their own band, but he says that's not the only thing unique about the group.
Tim, who's the drummer, grew up in this congregation, and he was in my confirmation class. He had his bar mitzvah here. But Josh and Eric and Aaron, they're not Jewish.
Most of them aren't Jewish, but Rabbi Mazo says they've become an institution at his congregation.
When the band is playing, that's when most of our people show up. There's kind of something magical that happens when you take ancient liturgical prayers and apply what they do musically to it. It just really makes it more accessible.
Where does the magic come from? The band pulls from a range of genres.
Contemporary Christian music, Beatles and Bob Dylan and Rolling Stones and so on.
The Dire Straits. I love James Taylor, some of those folk singers.
Josh Reedford was first in the band to get involved with music at the synagogue. He took an Intro to Judaism class at the University of Evansville, and his professor, who was rabbi at the time, invited Josh to services. Josh quickly found himself immersed in the congregation.
I met with the music director one afternoon, and he ran through all the music with me in a couple hours, and then he called me up the next day and he said, "Hey, we're all quitting, you're in charge now."
Eric Lund came on board shortly after.
I really only started to do this because there was free food after services.
His candor prompts some honesty from Josh.
If we're doing true confessions here, the only reason I kept coming back is I had a crush on the girl that was singing.
And then Josh's brother Aaron joined in.
I came back because I liked doing the music.
Eric says it took some time for him to learn a new tradition.
There's a language that you have to get an idea of what it means and what its history is and what its purpose is for within the context of the service.
But he got the hang of it. All three are trained musicians, and each has been, or is currently, the music director at the synagogue. Tim Gold hasn't been music director.
If we keep with this pattern, it looks like you're next, Tim.
But he does play drums in the band. He says he grew up with it.
Josh actually performed at my bar mitzvah. He would teach me the songs when I was like 13. He saw me pretty much grow up. I just kind of learned the music, and so it just kind of became a natural progression.
A band played at the Shabbat Rock service for years, but the guys say Kippa Groovin' really took off when Rabbi Mazo joined the synagogue in 2013. Eric says their album, Peace and Mercy, seemed like the obvious thing to do.
Once we actually had a band, we actually had a band name, it was just one of those, well, what's the next step? Well, we gotta make an album.
The songs are adaptations of common Jewish prayers, and the order follows the order of prayers at a Shabbat service. Josh says his time working at a Catholic church throughout high school and college may have influenced his approach to writing music.
I wanted to write songs that would have a nice melody but be easy for congregations to pick up on.
Aaron has also worked at a church. One of his first jobs out of college was playing the piano in a gospel choir.
I went into that job with my degree thinking, oh, I'm a great pianist because I have a degree in piano. And I realized that there are kinds of music that I know nothing about, and I had to learn how to play gospel style for that job.
It's that gospel sound that influenced their adaptation of the Shema, a short prayer that's central in Jewish liturgy.
The Shema came out of me just fiddling. What's one of my favorite things to do is fiddle around on the piano and just like this sort of gospel riffs type of style.
They continue to write songs. Most of the band no longer lives in the Evansville area, but when they're back together, they say the music flows.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, looks good.
I'm not so much about expressing what's in my soul as putting something out that I like aesthetically and I think would look good in someone's home.
Tastes better.
You will then want to just shovel in your mouth to finish the whole thing off.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. An Indianapolis couple is on a culinary mission of sorts to take the fear out of cooking. Their blog, A Couple Cooks, and cookbook, Pretty Simple Cooking, does just that. Curious Mix contributor Lee Dinoon takes us into their kitchen. Sonia and Alex Overheiser create something in their kitchen nearly every day, but that hasn't always been the case. When they married 11 years ago, they say cooking was a chore.
We bought a house and we wanted to have some people over for dinner, and we realized fast food and frozen food doesn't really cut it if you're having people for dinner. So we decided we needed to learn how to cook.
And this just kind of, from a few dinner parties, opened up this huge world to us of food that could taste good, that was fun to make. So for us, originally, it wasn't so much about eating healthy as it was just exploring food and new flavors. And cooking together, we just really enjoyed it as a new hobby that we had after we got married.
Sonia says a coworker gave them a Julia Child cookbook.
And at the time, I didn't know anything about Julia Child. I thought she was just some old lady who was irrelevant. And I picked up the book and started reading what she had to say, and I was blown away just by her personality, her way that she encouraged people, that even if you don't have any experience in cooking, you can do this too.
There you go, honey.
Thanks.
She started cooking at an older age. She went to France to start to kind of understand food and cooking, and the way that she said, you know, it doesn't matter if you've never tried it before, you can make an omelet. You can make fancy French food. You just have to get your hands dirty and try it and fail a few times. And so I was really captivated by her personality. We decided to try a few recipes of hers, and they worked out.
That success turned into their new hobby, having dinner parties.
Around the same time, we picked up a few books, In Defense of Food by Michael Pollan and Food Matters by Mark Bittman. And we thought we were just kind of reading them for fun, and they really kind of changed the way we saw food. That if you just eat a little bit less meat, a lot less processed food, but you don't turn it into a diet or something that's super strict, when you just start slowly changing the way you eat, that you can really enjoy food that's healthier for you, but also better for the overall food system.
So they started eating more vegetables and were inspired to try one meatless meal per week.
We were like, okay, let's have two meatless meals and let's start eating more vegetables. And we slowly just grew to really love eating vegetables. We found it was delicious and creative. Using vegetables as the main part of a meal makes you be creative in ways that you've never thought of before. And so we were having these colorful and delicious meals that made us feel really good afterwards. And we said, let's start sharing these recipes with the world.
The Overheisers started their blog, acoupleofcooks.com, in 2010 and added podcasts 3 years ago.
It's A Couple Cooks, the podcast with Sonia and Alex Overheiser. We're a couple on a mission to find the tastiest, good-for-you eats you can make in your kitchen.
Soon, they were thinking about creating a cookbook and proposed to create 100 new vegetarian recipes.
We wanted to have something physical that people could take away. We also have learned these lessons about how to fit cooking into your lifestyle that we really wanted to share.
And it's that sharing in all formats, social media, book, podcast, blog, and video, that has made them successful.
The table is this transformational place for us where we can overcome differences, where we can try new foods from new cultures, where we can listen to each other and just share together. And so that's really why we do what we do. It's not just about recipes or pretty food photographs. It's about coming together.
For Curious Mix, I'm Lee Dinoon. Speaking of food, it's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know where to find the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. If you're craving an authentic Jamaican meat patty, then head to Jamaican Reggae Grill.
Eldon Chuck, one of the owners here at Jamaican Reggae Grill. One of our most popular food item is a Jamaican beef patty. Not as sweet, but a very flaky exterior, and then the inside is filled with beef. We always say in Jamaica, 50% with the quality of the dough and 50% with the quality of the meat inside. If one is better than the other, then you don't have a real patty. It has to be equally important in taste. The dough is flour, salt, colored water using coloring derived from vegetable, shortening, and a little bit of beef fat as well. The beef fat basically has just a little bit higher smoke point than and allows us to bake at a higher temperature to get a little bit better flakiness on the dough. Two flavors that goes, the outside pastry, which at times maybe you expect it to be sweet, but it's not sweet. It has a benign flavor to it, but it mixes well with the meat that goes inside. The meat inside is not super spicy, but it does have a little bit of spice to it, and it does have a lot of flavors that we put in. Flavors that would be onion, a little mixture of onion, black pepper, allspice, scallions, thyme, and of course the Scotch bonnet pepper, but also provides a really nice citrusy flavor that it just warms the mouth. Best way to eat a patty is in a bag, so that you can, after you're done, there's a lot of flakes in the bag that you will then want to just shovel in your mouth to finish the whole thing off.
Jamaican Reggae Grill is located at 622 South Rangeline Road in Carmel. When your daily job involves managing artists, how do you find time to create your own work? Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez spends time in the office and studio with Rachel Ferguson.
I think that coming in here and hammering nails for like 2 hours straight is the best way to get over a long day.
Four little taps, another nail driven in. Rachel Ferguson works methodically, following a pattern she's used many times. This piece is a wooden block. The nails will become the shape of Indiana with a heart in the middle. It's one of Ferguson's most popular creations.
It's really an optical illusion. Each outside pin or nail that marks the outside of the Indiana gets one loop with the string, but the inside nails that define the heart get multiple wrappings. So it just ends up looking like it's twisting or it's radiating like that.
Ferguson creates string art, or as she prefers, string decor, specifically strung handmade decor, as she's named her line. She shies away from even referring to herself as an artist.
I'm surrounded by artists all day, and I see how much time people dedicate to their craft and, you know, the intentionality with which they show their message through their work. And the type of work I do, I consider much more decorative. Like, I'm not so much about expressing what's in my soul as putting something out that I like aesthetically and I think would look good in someone's home.
But Ferguson does have a distinctive aesthetic to her work. On blocks of various sizes, she uses stains to enhance the string shapes.
I've always enjoyed painting, and I've always enjoyed stuff that requires really meticulous work. So when I stain my backboards, I do it with really teeny tiny brushes. I mix some of my own stains. I mix wood dyes to create the colors I want. And then I have to do, you know, layer after layer to get the colors I want. But then I think the string, if you don't put the string on, it just kind of ends up being like an average piece, but then the string on top of it, and it creates that dimension.
The result is an almost stained glass effect. Her most recent series focuses on mountains geometrically built within a ring of nails, with fades of red, orange, or blue stain peeking through. Ferguson has created scarab beetles, the cosmic zodiac, even earthly wildlife like bears or whales.
The whale, I was so proud of myself on that one that I managed to define his little fin. It took me a while to figure out how to do that. There's a little bit of trial and error in all of these. I've thrown away a lot of pieces that I'm like, that does not look like a wolf or whatever. That looks like a lump. We're going to try something else.
Ferguson relocated to Indianapolis from Maine and describes herself as an art nerd, having taken advantage of her hometown's art educational opportunities. In her past, she's worked in graphic design.
So my string art has kind of ended up being this problem-solving challenge for me, where how do I come up with a geometric representation of a bear or a bird or a whale that looks like what it is as minimalist as possible, uses as few pieces of string as possible, and I set this own little personal challenge that I won't go over any same line twice with a piece of string. Which is, you know, doesn't matter. I don't know. It's something that makes it a little bit fun for me.
It all goes back into that need to blow off steam and find her zen. Ferguson is the vice president of Tegan Development and the property manager of the Tegan-owned Circle City Industrial Complex. Her studio space is on the second floor of the North Studio section of the building, a welcoming environment to the beat of her work.
Apartment because my neighbors would kill me. So managing a building this size with this many tenants, there's always going to be something going on, and we're a really small team. But for the most part, and this is going to sound really corny, but honestly, I try to never miss a First Friday event here, because when I walk through and I see people come into the building, they see the stuff that's going on here for the first time, and they're so amazed by it. It just makes everything worth it.
When Larry Jones, the president of Tegan Development, bought the CCIC nearly 4 years ago, initially Ferguson was hesitant about the project, largely because of the building's name.
When he said industrial complex, I thought, oh no, I don't want to be part of this. And then when he said, oh yeah, there's some art studios in there, I said, okay, yeah, all right, I could get on board with that. So it's been nice because I've worked in real estate for a long time, and switching to doing property management has been different, but doing it in a building full of artists has made me feel tied to creativity in my day job.
With about 30 artists in the building 4 years ago, Tegan has pledged to keep the CCIC as creative-friendly as possible. Newly built studio spaces are opening up, and renovations are occurring throughout the center of the building. Ferguson estimates that nearly 80 artists are now calling the building home. The massive building is quickly becoming an in-demand arts hub.
Artists make up about 10% of our total square footage in this building. But I get more studio inquiries. I get people inquiring about, you know, I have this idea for a gallery show. Do you have space that I can do it? And to be able to say yes is so fantastic.
The nearby Windsor Park neighborhood is blossoming, and tales of gentrification and rising rents are sweeping through the near downtown area, so Ferguson has used a pragmatic outlook to find the best way to help artists hang on, maintaining a community without going broke in doing so.
Artists need space they can afford. They're not making a lot of money off of this, so it's really a labor of love. They need low rents, but then having a concentration of other artists around them. Because on a First Friday, you're not going to go to a building that has one art studio, but you might go to one that has 50. So we really want to make sure that that is always present here, because that's what keeps the community really vibrant. So to be able to have, in a way, the artist rent subsidized by the people who rent 10,000 square feet and do warehousing and distribution, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't behoove me to double an artist's rent, because that's not going to move the needle on what I'm collecting every month for my rent roll. So what happens is, for the larger spaces, you know, we're bringing those spaces up to market rents where they weren't previously, and that's what allows us to have art spaces in here. People come in, they're like, okay, wait, so you have art studios and you have a brewery, but you also have these people who, you know, distribute car parts, and then you have a metal shop, and it just doesn't make a lot of sense to people. But as far as the mix, it totally makes sense. It's like its own little ecosystem.
The diversity of the building has almost become something of a collaborative skills bazaar, a feature that has even helped Ferguson in her own work. When she doesn't know how or have the capability to do part of a project, others in the building might be able to lend a hand.
I picked Brian Presnell's brain. I mean, he does woodworking. He has for years. He owns Indie Urban Hardwood. I went to him and I said, okay, what is a local wood that doesn't have a strong grain that's easy to hammer into? And he just gave me some options. And it would have taken me forever to figure out on that on my own. I mean, you don't see a table saw in my space, but I have these perfect backboards. I go down to Project Leah and they cut my backboards for me, so I don't have to worry about that.
Freeing up more time for Hammer Time. For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this curious mix was created by
Terry Border,
Roxana Caldwell,
Melissa Davis,
Sarah Neil Estes,
Lee Danoon,
Kyle Long,
Matt Pelser,
Bob Williams,
Joy Hernandez,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.